Hello and welcome to today's episode of the Not Just a Lawyer podcast. Today I will be talking about the recent High Court decision about what happened in the Dondale Detention Centre. That's a juvenile detention centre in the Northern Territory. As usual, I'm lucky enough to be recording this podcast on the traditional lands of the Ngunnawal people. I recognise them as the traditional custodians of the land and I pay my respects to their elders past and present. When you listen to this podcast, you might notice something interesting, which is that I use fairly different tones throughout it. Sometimes I'm pretty clinical and sometimes I'm reflective. And this is because I record the podcast in segments. And in those segments where I had just finished reading the words of the judgment and was digesting it pretty much on the fly, the kind of language I use tends to be a bit more formal. As a lawyer, it is really important that when we are in court, we use honorifics for people. That's Mr., Ms., things like that. We don't tend to use their first names, and sometimes that can sound very formal and strange. And I think that my use of the honorifics throughout this podcast might make it seem to the casual listener like I'm talking about adults, but really throughout this podcast, I'm talking about children. And I just want to make that really clear up front. You will also hear, if you listen closely, some protesting from some cats. I didn't catch that until a bit later when I was listening through again. It's impossible for me to edit it out without having to do a significant amount of work. And while I'm all for doing a significant amount of work, I'm also wary of failing to put this out in a timely fashion because I'm trying to make it perfect. For me, it's more important that you learn about things that you don't know about, particularly as they relate to the incarceration of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. I don't want to let the great be the enemy of the good or adequate piece of information that I hope you get out of this podcast today. So thanks again for listening. And thanks for bearing with me as I go through this fairly difficult topic. You'll also notice that this is a really long podcast. There's a lot to unpack. So I hope you're ready. Let's go. The High Court of Australia was looking at the matter of Binsaris against the Northern Territory. This matter was decided on the 3rd of June 2020, and there were four appellants in the matter. These appellants were Josiah Binsaris, Kieran Webster, Leroy O'Shea, and Ethan Ostrell. And each of them were suing the Northern Territory of Australia. A little bit further into the podcast, I talk about the appellants and who they were and what they were doing. The appellants are these four people. In August 2014, when this incident occurred, they were all children and they were incarcerated in the Dondale Detention Centre in the Northern Territory. I would encourage you, if you want more information about Dondale and what has happened with that detention centre, to do a bit of a Google and get some background information on it for yourself. Today, I'll be focusing on the judgment of the High Court of Australia. Now, that court consisted of five judges, the Chief Justice, Kiefel, and Justices Gageler, Keane, Gordon, and Edelman. The judgment is actually three judgments, but they all arrive at the same final decision. Four of the judgments get there in much the same way. One takes a slightly different path. So as we go through this podcast, I will be talking through the judgments in the order that they were published by the court. So first, we have the joint judgment of Chief Justice Kiefel and Justice Keane. Then we have the judgment of Justice Gageler. And finally, we have the judgment of Justices Gordon and Edelman. And I'll talk through those. I'll also talk to you about the differences, and more about the matter will emerge as we go through the various judgments. I'll also be making a digression partway through to give you some information on a substance known as CS fogging or tear gas. So please hold on to your hats, bear with me, and have a very open mind and readiness to have a think about some things that crop up during this podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. This is a tricky one, but it's really, really important that we all know about this and that we all do some thinking about it. It's really important for you to understand that this case is not a criminal law case. It was heard by the High Court of Australia. It got up there by going through various appeal courts. And what was actually being looked at was whether the state of the Northern Territory had committed what's called a tort against four particular people. A tort is a civil law wrong, so it might sometimes have overlap with a crime. In this particular matter, they were alleging that they had experienced the tort of battery. Battery means unlawful touching of someone in any way, basically, if I could put it in a nutshell. So there's some overlap, you'll probably be thinking, with the crime of assault, which is also unauthorized touching, no consent, no reasonable excuse. They're really similar. So in this case, four youths who were in a detention center were suing the state of the Northern Territory, or the Territory, for the tort of battery. I'm going to go into this in a heap more detail, but I just wanted to let you know what we're looking at overall. And the decision in this matter is known as Binsaris against the Northern Territory. That's Binsaris, Binsaris, against the Northern Territory, 2020 HCA 22. If you wanted to look it up yourself, if you Google Binsaris and Northern Territory, odds are extremely good that you'll find it. I'm taking my information from the High Court of Australia website. So I have looked at the judgment in full. I'm also looking at the judgment summary as a helpful guide for me when I'm giving you some brief background information. The decision was given by the court on the 3rd of June 2020, so it's extremely recent. And the court was consisting of Chief Justice Kiefel and Justices Gageler, Keane, Gordon and Edelman. Now, when we look at the catchwords that the court headnote writer uses to give members of the public a bit of a clue about what the matter was about, we see certain things. We see tort, battery, statutory authorization, where CS gas, in brackets, form of tear gas, used by prison officer in youth detention centre. Where prison officer called to assist at youth detention centre. Where detainees exposed to CS gas claimed damages for battery. Where device used to deploy CS gas prohibited weapon under Weapons Control Act, Northern Territory. Where the deployment of CS gas by prison officer in youth detention centre lawful. Where the prison officer such that exemption for prescribed persons in Section 12(2) of Weapons Control Act applied. Whether authorised by delegation of powers of Superintendent of Youth Detention Centre under Section 157(2) of Youth Justice Act Northern Territory. Whether authorised by prison officer having powers of police officer under Section 9 of Prisons Correctional Services Act Northern Territory. The headnote writer also points out that there are certain words and phrases that come up in this judgment. Acting in the course of his or her duties, battery, bodily integrity, breach of the peace, bystander, collateral damage, detainees, emergency situation, ensure the safe custody and protection, maintain discipline, maintain order, necessary or convenient, police officer, positive authority, prescribed person, prison officer, prisoner, prohibited weapon, superintendent, tortious liability, use of force that is reasonably necessary, Youth Detention Centre. Particular legislation that's referred to in this judgment is the Prisons Correctional Services Act of the Northern Territory, the Weapons Control Act of the Northern Territory, and the Youth Justice Act of the Northern Territory. So already from the headnote, we can glean that the tort of battery is being alleged. We can glean that a form of tear gas was used by a prison officer in a youth detention centre. And we can see that the main argument is about whether it's enough that someone says they're acting in the course of their duties and whether they were actually really authorised to use that tear gas in circumstances where they thought they were maintaining discipline, maintaining order, and acting in ways that they thought was consistent with their duties in this detention centre. Now, the judgment is 43 pages long, and I would not normally name the people involved because they were children at the time, but they've used their full names, and I'm happy to do that as well. So the matter is known as Binsaris. That's named after the plaintiff who, in the High Court, was the appellant because he was appealing against earlier decisions. There were four appellants, and the one who's listed first is Josiah Binsaris. The second appellant is Kieran Webster. The third appellant is Leroy O'Shea. And the fourth appellant is Ethan Austral. And each of those four people are suing the Northern Territory of Australia. Now, the High Court allowed their appeal. So Josiah Binsaris, Kieran Webster, Leroy O'Shea, and Ethan Austral were all ultimately successful in suing the Northern Territory for battery. The High Court has remitted the matter, that means sending it back, to another judge of the Supreme Court of the Northern Territory. And that judge has to assess damages that should be paid to these four people for what they suffered in the Dondale Detention Centre. So let's talk about that a bit more. Each appellant in this matter was represented by the North Australian Aboriginal Justice Agency. They were four Indigenous men who were being held in the Dondale Youth Detention Centre. Most of you know that's located in the Northern Territory. And when this all took place, it was the 21st of August 2014. At that time, it was approved as a youth detention centre under Section 148 of the Youth Justice Act Northern Territory. What happened was the four appellants in this matter and a bunch of other people were detained in a place called the Behavioural Management Unit of that Dondale Detention Centre. Someone else who was detained in there, Mr. Roper, escaped from his cell. He damaged some property and he caused a big disturbance. I'm getting this from the judgment of Chief Justice Kiefel and Justice Keane. The two appellants, Josiah Binsaris and Ethan Austral, they were participating a little bit in that disturbance. They damaged some property inside their own cells. Now, the superintendent of the detention centre contacted the director of correctional services. They mobilised members of the immediate action team, which included three prison officers from Berrima Correctional Centre, and that immediate action team arrived at Dondale Youth Detention Centre. And while they were there, they thought the situation couldn't be resolved, particularly with Mr. Roper. So the Director of Correctional Services gave a direction to the prison officers who were there as part of that immediate action team that CS gas, which is a type of tear gas, could be deployed. So basically, the Director of Correctional Services said to those prison officers, yep, you can use tear gas. They read out a warning to Jake Roper. He didn't comply with the warning, and so one of the prison officers deployed that CS gas in bursts until Mr. Roper ceased engaging in the disturbance. And when that CS gas or tear gas was deployed in those bursts, all of the appellants in this matter, so that's Josiah Binsaris, Kieran Webster, Leroy O'Shea and Ethan Ostrell. They were all also exposed to that tear gas. We might pause there to have a think about some current circumstances where a lot of people are being exposed to tear gas. And we know that in the United States there are a lot of protests going on in various cities, and all of us have probably seen on the news that tear gas is being used by police. For what reason, I'm not completely clear, but it seems to be being used allegedly to control the protesters, to make it less attractive to protest, and probably allegedly to make it less attractive to be out after curfews. But I'll leave it to you to think about whether that's something that should be happening or not, and whether that's something that you could think is justified or not. That is probably a matter for you to determine for yourself. In this particular matter, we know that they're in a youth detention centre. You can probably picture what that might look like. I haven't seen photographs of Don Dale, so I don't know whether this was being used in an enclosed space or not. I have a feeling that the judgment is going to speak a bit more about all of that, and we'll all come to a better understanding of what happened. There are a couple of things that we should pause and think about before we move on. The first is that each of these appellants at the time of this incident, which was 2014, 6 years ago, was an Aboriginal kid in a detention centre, so a youth detention centre. So let's think about the setting that we're in. It's a place where people are confined. It's a place where they're locked up because the state has said that they should be. And importantly, they're kids. So immediately they're vulnerable. They're away from their families, they're under the control of the state, and their children. And on top of that, they're Aboriginal children, so they have further vulnerabilities. As we know, there are a lot of factors that go into the mix of why Aboriginal kids are in the justice system so much more frequently than white kids. There is a well-known correlation between early encounters with child protection and ending up in the juvenile justice system. And we need to think very carefully back to our history of stealing Aboriginal children from their families and thinking that we know best about how their lives should be going, because that intervention continues today. Now, in some cases, it will be justified, but I think in every case where someone is looking at whether an Aboriginal child should be removed from their home, they need to be thinking really carefully about why they think that. Because getting involved in other people's lives, particularly children, and forcing them to be encountering child protection and things like that really increases their risk of being involved in the criminal justice system down the track. We also need to look at the general significant overrepresentation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in our criminal justice system. They are a tiny fraction of our population, but they're in our jails, they're before our courts at very high rates. And the explanation for this is racism. It is not that the most incarcerated people on the planet are criminals. It is that we look at them as though they are criminals and we see what we want to see. We are more punitive. We take action. We make reports against Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people when we would not do that if we saw the same behaviour by a white person. It is because we are racist as a society. More likely, this racism is something that you don't know you have, but it infects your thinking. And that's why it's really important that every single one of us reflects and tries to think about how we can do better and be better. And importantly, that we think before we take reflexive action about what we're about to do and why. And I think uncomfortably we will find that a lot of the time we are going to do something has no basis in fact. It comes from our emotions and it comes from what we've been taught, and we have to unlearn it. I'm stepping away from the High Court judgment for a minute to tell you a little bit about what CS gas actually is, because I didn't know and I needed to find out. I've gone to a website called aftermath.com and it explains a little bit about CS gas. The compound usually used is called 0-chlorobenzylidenomalonitrile, CS. It's often referred to as CS gas, but it's not actually a gas. It's a synthetic organic halogen compound that has a powder-like consistency at room temperature. Physical effects of CS gas can include extreme burning of the nose, extreme burning of the eyes, and extreme burning of the throat. It can cause involuntary closing of the eyes, coughing, a rise in blood pressure, secreting mucus, nausea, and vomiting. So it's pretty unpleasant. It affects your nose, eyes, and throat. It might raise your blood pressure. It might cause you to throw up. It might cause mucus to run around, like your eyes and nose and things like that. It sounds pretty unpleasant. Now, it can be deployed in lots of different ways, but the judgment says that it was used in a fogger. Now, a fogger is something that pictures of it look to me a bit like a weed sprayer. I don't know what they actually use, but if you kind of picture a weed sprayer, it sprays CS gas in a spray pattern. It's made up of finer droplets that can linger in the air longer when it's used in a fogger. And this is all from aftermath.com. While I don't have the material safety data sheet for the CS spray used at Don Dale, I have found one from another manufacturer. It relates to a product that goes under the trade name MK9 CS Mace Fogger. Sometimes the word mace is used to kind of identify that it's a stingy sort of gas, and I guess to allude to the trade name mace. So it's noted as a health hazard. It may cause allergy or asthma symptoms or breathing difficulties if inhaled. It causes skin irritation. It causes serious eye irritation. It may cause an allergic skin reaction. It may cause respiratory irritation. It may be fatal if swallowed and enters airways, so that means if you actually drink it as opposed to having it fogged on you. It's dangerous to the environment, to aquatic organisms, sorry, I was going to say organisers. So it is something that's considered dangerous. It has to have a signal word danger on it. And there's a note as a precautionary statement. In case of inadequate ventilation, wear respiratory protection, wear protective gloves/protective clothing/eye protection/face protection, wash thoroughly after handling. If in eyes, rinse cautiously with water for several minutes. Remove contact lenses, if present and easy to do so. Continue rinsing. If experiencing respiratory symptoms, call a poison center or doctor/physician. If skin irritation or rash occurs, get medical advice/attention. If on skin, wash with plenty of water. So that's the safety data sheet for a particular product. Its printing date was September 3rd, 2014. As I said, I don't know what exact product was being used in Dondale, but this is a document that was around about the same time for a similar product. There's a section on first aid measures. Description of first aid measures. General information. Take affected persons out into the fresh air. Symptoms of poisoning may even occur after several hours. Therefore, medical observation for at least 48 hours after the accident. Now, they're talking about an accident, but we're talking about this being deliberately fogged at kids. After inhalation, supply fresh air. Consult doctor in case of complaints. Provide oxygen treatment if affected person has difficulty breathing. In case of unconsciousness, place patient stably inside position for transportation. After skin contact, immediately wash with water and soap and rinse thoroughly. If skin irritation continues, consult a doctor. After eye contact, remove contact lenses if worn. Rinse opened eye for several minutes under running water. If symptoms persist, consult a doctor. After swallowing, rinse out mouth and then drink plenty of water. Do not induce vomiting. Call for medical help immediately. A person vomiting while laying on their back should be turned onto their side. Most important symptoms and effects, both acute and delayed. Asthma attacks, headache, breathing difficulty, dizziness, coughing, allergic reactions, irritant to skin and mucous membranes, irritant to eyes. There are some further hazards. Danger of pulmonary edema. Danger of impaired breathing. Vapors may cause drowsiness and dizziness. Indication of any immediate medical attention and special treatment needed. May produce a lacrimethatory laryngospastic effect. Basically, it might make your larynx spasm. That's bad. If swallowed or in case of vomiting, danger of entering the lungs. So you might accidentally vomit and get this in your lungs if you breathe in the vomit. That's called aspiration, basically. Severe allergic skin reaction, bronchial spasms, and anaphylactic shock are possible. In case of irritation to the lungs, initial treatment with corticosteroid inhalants. If necessary, oxygen respiration treatment. Medical supervision for at least 48 hours. So it's not the nicest product. It's meant to hurt. People using it are recommended to wear personal protective equipment and to keep unprotected persons away from them. They're supposed to ensure adequate ventilation. They're supposed to be able to isolate the area where it was used and prevent access to it. And it also appears pretty clear that if this is used, people probably need to be medically monitored for quite a while afterwards, and they certainly need to have the fumes and things washed from their eyes, their skin, their mouths, and things like that. If we think about that, this means that after being sprayed, it would be necessary for people to then have access to doctors, access to showers and things like that. I don't know how all this took place, but in my mind, I'm thinking that it sounds like it occurred during a conflict. It then hurt people involved in the conflict, and it may well have involved them being manhandled, for lack of a better word, towards showers and other things to get this washed off them, which sounds pretty traumatic to me. We'll go a bit further through this safety data sheet. If you want to find it for yourself, if you Google sdschemtel.net, that's chemtel.net, and if you look at CS Gas, you'll probably find this. And as I said, the one I'm reading is for MK9 CS Mace Fogger. There's some further information. Section 11 of this document is toxicological information. So the primary irritant effect is an irritant to skin and mucous membranes. and an irritating effect on the eye. It notes that sensitization is possible through inhalation and skin contact. That means people who have this used on them repeatedly might become more sensitive to it, so it has a worse effect on them. There's additional toxicological information. The product shows the following dangers according to the calculation method of the general EU classification guidelines for preparations as issued in the latest version. Harmful, irritant, danger through skin absorption. Inhalation of concentrated vapors as well as oral intake will lead to anesthesia-like conditions and headache, dizziness, etc. Toxic and/or corrosive effects may be delayed up to 24 hours, may be harmful if inhaled. Acute effects. Vapors have narcotic effect. Sensitization, possible by inhalation and/or dermal contact, so on the skin. Repeated dose toxicity. May cause damage to organs through prolonged or repeated exposure. Repeated exposures may result in skin and/or respiratory sensitivity. That means that, as I said, the more it is used on you, the worse your symptoms might be. So it's not the friendliest product out there, and it was being used in a youth detention center on people who are typically that population are going to be highly vulnerable folks. I can't stress enough that the people in there were children, and they were also Aboriginal children involved in this particular matter as the plaintiffs, so highly vulnerable population. Now, it's been a couple of years since I worked on a battery matter. That's, as I said before, a civil claim for battery. But one of the things that might excuse a battery is if there's a reasonable excuse or it's lawfully authorised. Those things often go hand in hand. So a large part of the judgment is really focused on whether this was something that was actually authorised. That is, were these people allowed to use this CS fogger on these kids in the detention centre? Was it actually authorised by law? So we're going to get a little bit technical. A CS fogger is a prohibited weapon under the Northern Territory's Weapons Control Act. But some people are allowed to have those prohibited weapons. There are some exceptions. Some of those people are officers defined in Section 5 of the Prisons Correctional Services Act of the Northern Territory and a police officer. They don't include a superintendent of a detention centre. And the court has looked at it carefully and they think that the exemption that lets a particular person carry the CS fogger, which is an otherwise prohibited weapon, could only apply if a member of the immediate action team who used the CS fogger was supplied to that person for the performance of their duties as a prison officer, and they were acting in the course of their duties as a prison officer when they used it. Now, the Prisons Act defines what a prison officer is. And the court goes through this quite carefully. What the court notes is that prison officers have certain powers, which we're not going to go into, they're pretty detailed, but they have certain powers about what they can and can't do in prisons. And prison officers can be asked by a superintendent of a detention centre to help out in an emergency situation. And in that situation, a prison officer or a police officer is taken to have been delegated the powers of the superintendent necessary to perform the superintendent's functions under the Youth Justice Act. So they step into the shoes not in their usual role as prison officer, but they step into the shoes of the superintendent of the detention centre. Now, guess who is not an authorised person for possessing and using a CS fogger? You would be right if you guessed a superintendent is not. Now, those prison officers, they step in, they probably think that they're authorized to use this CS FOGA. They think that they're acting in the course of their duties as a prison officer. But as we said before, this is a detention center. It is not a prison. It is for youth. This is where there is actually some recognition that the people we're dealing with here are children, not adults. Now, to the people in the detention center, it's probably no different. Calling it a detention center or a jail, their lives are probably pretty bloody similar, which is terrible, but it's actually come a little bit useful in this particular matter, because the High Court found that the prison officers who used the CS foggers were not authorized to do so. It's not that they didn't think they were. They weren't necessarily acting in bad faith or anything like that. Though you might question, you know, the decision to use a CS fogger against children. But what it really comes down to is a legal definition about what their role actually is as a prison officer, and then what they're allowed to do when they are asked to come in by the superintendent and help out in a youth detention centre. If we take a couple of steps back, this is really important. We can see that when writing this legislation, the legislators had in mind that a youth detention centre was a different type of facility to an adult jail. The court noted, but it didn't have to rely on this to make its decision, that Section 153, subsection 1 of the Youth Justice Act requires the superintendent of a detention centre to maintain discipline at the detention centre. They can use the force that is reasonably necessary in the circumstances, but Section 153, subsection 3 states that that does not include the use of physical violence, enforced dosing with medicine, drug, or other substance, compelling a person to remain in a constrained or fatiguing position, or using handcuffs or other restraints. There's a temporary exemption under Section 153, subsection 4 that lets them use handcuffs or other restraints in an emergency situation. They're also allowed to isolate people for the protection of others or for the good order or security of the detention centre, but nowhere in the Youth Justice Act is there the mention that you can use weapons against detainees. And the court has noted that, taken as a whole, Section 153 of the Youth Justice Act tends to suggest that it is not contemplated that there will be the use of any weapons against these detainees. The court didn't need to rely on that, though, to make its decision. It's just something that they noted and pointed out. And so I think it's worth noting and pointing out to you as well. Now, the appellants in this matter, they were kids when this happened. They made a claim for battery against the Northern Territory government. The primary judge found that they were partially made out because these claims initially also, they weren't just for the use of CS gas, this tear gas. They also included the use of spit hoods and leg shackles. And then for three of these appellants, they included the use of spit hoods, leg shackles, and handcuffs. So the claims partly succeeded initially, but the claims, the parts of them in relation to the tear gas didn't get up, basically. So they were appealed in relation to the tear gas, and it went through all the levels of appeal until it got up to the High Court. So what you need to know is that while this case looks formally like it's just about tear gas against kids, these kids were also shackled. They had spit hoods applied to them. They were handcuffs. So there was some pretty severe treatment going on that day in August 2014. And I guess we want to know, probably in our own minds, is that something that was common? Was it uncommon? What was the environment like there that these kids were living in? I don't know the answer to that, and I would like to know. Now, the High Court looked carefully, as I said, about whether these officers were acting in the course of their duty. And they found that they weren't. And as I said, it doesn't mean that the officers knew they were doing the wrong thing. It's probable that they thought they were acting within their powers. But let's talk about that a little bit more. Let's talk a bit more about what was actually going on that day. Justice Gageler talks about it in a little more depth because there are some separate judgments delivered in this matter. Now, these officers had masks, helmets, protective vests, shields and batons that they brought with them to the Dondale Detention Centre. They were there to deal with a situation where Mr. Roper was in the exercise yard and he was said to be behaving in a violent and erratic manner that was thought to pose a danger to the staff of the detention centre and to himself. And that is why the director authorised a member of the immediate action team to deploy as much CS gas as was necessary to subdue Mr. Roper. So, the appellants in this matter, the four kids, they were exposed to CS gas in their cells in the behaviour management unit. So it seems like it may have flowed past where Mr. Roper was in the yard and sort of, I guess, fogged its way into their actual cells where they were living. Very interestingly, Justice Gageler, unlike Chief Justice Kiefel and Justice Keane, found that there was an implied authority for the prison officers to use the CS fogger. He thought that actually, if you looked at the law carefully, it was allowed. But he also thought that the appeals should be successful. In layperson terms, he was on the side, ultimately, of the four appellants, the four kids. And the reason he came down in their favour is because he thought that while the police were authorised to use this CS fogger on Mr. Roper, they weren't authorised to go beyond that. And he noted that it was going to happen that the CS gas, when it was used, was going to affect other people and that they knew that. And that it wasn't absolutely necessary for that to happen. He thought that it went too far. He noted that the slightest intentional non-consensual interference with the physical integrity of a person can, of course, constitute a battery. He talked about the general give and take that we have in everyday society. I might accidentally bump into someone when I'm walking. While that's a slight non-consensual interference, it's not intentional. But he does note that minor intentional physical contact between bystanders and police, for example, if there's a breach of the peace, that might occur. And that minor intentional physical contact would probably see the police and probably the bystanders escape liability for battery. He also gave the example of a passenger being bumped on public transport by a conductor removing a drunk and disorderly passenger. And so he recognises that there's a bit of give and take in terms of battery, but he says there is, however, a difference between a police officer taking intentional action, which involves minor and incidental physical contact with a bystander, and a police officer taking intentional action, which involves a calculated choice to do an act which it is known will cause harm to a bystander in order to avoid a risk of greater harm to the police officer or to someone else. So he's saying in this matter, yep, they were looking at containing Mr. Roper. They thought he was a danger to himself and to the staff, but they didn't think he was a danger to other detainees, other kids in the prison, and they made a calculated decision about using the CS fogger on him, knowing that it would cause harm to other bystanders, so other kids in the prison. So he came down on the side of looking at the common law finding that there is a privilege or immunity that police might have when they have their duties to act, they can use force reasonably necessary to restrain or prevent a breach of the peace, but it provides a defence to a claim in battery by the person who Gageler says is the wrongdoer, so that is the target of the police's use of force. In this matter, that would be Mr. Roper. So he's saying, look, Mr. Roper wouldn't be able to make a claim in battery successfully. The police would have a defence to that. But he says, the common law immunity, in his opinion, is not such to provide a defence to a claim in battery by a bystander who suffers collateral harm by reason of the necessitous use of force. The bystander is entitled to damages at common law to compensate for the harm, for the simple reason that the use of force has interfered with the bystander's bodily integrity. So basically, yep, the police officer thought that they needed to use force. He's using police officer and prison officer in a sort of interchangeable way, or he's using police officer where before the other judges were talking about prison officers. That's probably a clearer way to put it. He's saying, look, they interfered with these people's bodily integrity, the four appellants in this matter, the four kids, and they did so in a way that they knew would affect other people. It wasn't just limited to using force or physical contact or interfering with the bodily integrity of Mr. Roper. And he says, therefore, the common law excuse for doing that, it just doesn't exist. There's no excuse for doing it to these other four people. It's too significant. It's not incidental. It's not in the usual give and take. It was calculated and on purpose. And it's not justified at common law, he says. We now look at the joint judgment of Justices Gordon and Edelman. So we can see that the judgment has been split into three parts. There's Chief Justice Kiefel and Justice Keane did a joint judgment, and then Justice Gageler did his own, and now Justices Gordon and Edelman are giving their judgment. They again talk about what CS gas is. They talk about it being a prohibited weapon, only allowed to be used by proscribed people in certain circumstances. They go a bit more into what led up to this. So on the evening of the 21st of August 2014, the appellants, along with two other detainees, were detained in the Behavioural Management Unit of the Dondale Detention Centre. These justices give us a bit more inside information about what this looked like. So they said it was five cells adjoining an enclosed exercise yard. The first cell was vacant. The appellants Kieran Webster and Leroy O'Shea occupied the second cell. The appellants Josiah Binsaris and Ethan Ostrell occupied the fourth cell. Jake Roper, that's Mr. Roper who I've talked about earlier, occupied the third cell. And another detainee occupied the fifth cell. So Mr. Roper and that other unnamed detainee are not involved in these proceedings. So Jake Roper and Josiah Binsaris and Ethan Ostrell, they covered the cameras in their cells with toilet paper. They kicked their cell doors. They yelled stuff. Okay, the judges don't say they yelled stuff. They say they yelled various statements. Broke the lights in their cells and removed the metal brackets attached to the lights. Jake Roper smashed a hole in the metal mesh of his door. He put his hand through the hole and opened the door, which was not locked, but could only be opened from outside the cell, and he went into the exercise yard. There, among other things, he damaged property, broke windows, and caused a disturbance. Josiah Binsaris and Ethan Ostrell smashed a hole about the size of a soccer ball in the metal mesh of their cell door. They used a metal bracket taken from the light in their cell to chip pieces of concrete render from the walls to throw at staff entering the BMU, that's the Behavioural Management Unit. They remained in their cell. Kieran Webster and Leroy O'Shea played cards in their cell. So you can see that Josiah Binsaris and Ethan Ostrell were involved in the unrest, whereas Kieran Webster and Leroy O'Shea were not. Just after 5 o'clock p.m., a youth justice officer telephoned the deputy superintendent and assistant general manager of the detention centre and told him that detainees in the behavioural management unit were being disorderly and throwing pieces of concrete at staff. The superintendent instructed the youth justice officer to monitor the situation and give the detainees time to calm down. So that was just after 5 p.m. that call was made. At 7:45 p.m., the superintendent of the detention centre telephoned the deputy superintendent and told him that the detainees in the behavioural management unit hadn't settled down and were becoming increasingly aggressive and violent towards youth justice officers. At about 8 o'clock p.m., the deputy superintendent and two youth justice officers who had a good relationship with the detainees in the behavioural management unit arrived at the detention centre. The deputy superintendent formed the opinion that his presence was aggravating Mr. Roper, and so he left. Various phone calls were made, and ultimately the superintendent called the acting general manager of Berrima Correctional Centre, which is an adult prison, and asked him to mobilise members of the immediate action team and also to mobilise a dog handler and a general purpose dog and to send those people to the Dondale Detention Centre. So three members of the immediate action team turned up at about 8:30. They were equipped with masks, helmets, protective vests, shields, batons and CS foggers. The superintendent asked them if they could remove glass that had come through the corridor, but when they attempted to do so, some things were thrown at them. And then Mr. Roper squirted a fire extinguisher through a broken window and discharged dry powder at them, so they couldn't see very well. I'm sort of paraphrasing now what's set out in the judgment of Justices Gordon and Edelman. So if you think, gee, those judges sound a bit informal, that's just me. Sorry about that. The superintendent then went back and he was escorted by a member of the IAT. Apologies, I'm going to backtrack. The deputy superintendent turned up. He was escorted by the superintendent to the dining area at the end of a corridor that led to the behavioural management unit. He was briefed. He saw youth justice officers trying to talk to Jake Roper and also to recover debris from the behavioural management unit. That wasn't successful. He suggested that they use the general purposes dog and that it be sent through the basketball court door to the behavioural management unit to distract Mr. Roper so that the IAT could go in and restrain him, but that didn't work. They weren't able to actually open the door to put the dog in there because Mr. Roper had damaged the lock, hitting it with a fire extinguisher. And the court notes that there was what the Youth Justice Act refers to as an emergency situation. So because things weren't working, Mr. Middlebrook purportedly authorised the deployment of CS gas by the IAT. Before it was used, one member of the IAT, who was a prison officer, read out a formal statement, which was, "On the orders of the officer in charge of the prison and the powers invested in me, you are ordered to stop your actions and do as I instruct you immediately. If you fail to do so, chemical agents and physical control will be used to restore the security and good order of the prison." So Mr. Roper didn't comply. So one member of the IAT, that's the immediate action team, who was a prison officer, deployed the CS gas. The first deployment was three short bursts of less than 1 second each into the behavioural management unit. There was a second deployment lasting 2 seconds. Those two didn't stop Mr. Roper from engaging in the behaviour he was engaging in. So there was a further deployment of 6 short bursts into the behavioural management unit, and after that Mr. Roper became compliant. What that means, we can only guess. The IAT, the immediate action team, entered the behavioural management unit and they removed Mr. Roper from there. Once he was taken out, they unlocked all of the cells in the behavioural management unit and they took the detainees out. They were all exposed to and affected by the CS gas. They were handcuffed behind their backs and they were taken to the basketball court where they were hosed down to remove the residue of the CS gas, and then they were then transferred to Berrima Correctional Centre and then to Holtz Correctional Centre. So, as I speculated before, being exposed to this did involve a bit of a forceful aftermath. So being handcuffed behind their backs and hosed down, to me that sounds deeply unpleasant, and I can't even imagine what it would actually feel like to be exposed to the CS gas itself. It sounds horrible. Now, as I said before, there were earlier successful claims by these people, but they were unsuccessful in relation to the claims of battery arising from the use of this CS gas, which, as we've said before, is a type of tear gas. And that was for placing them in spit hoods, leg shackles, handcuffing them behind their backs rather than in front, on their way to the medical area at Berrima Correctional Centre on the 22nd of August 2014. All of this was seen as pretty serious behaviour, and Joseph Binsaris and Ethan Austral were awarded aggravated damages of $2,000 each, so not large amounts. Kieran Webster and Leroy O'Shea were awarded aggravated damages of $7,000 each, and that probably reflects the fact that they were actually just playing cards in their cell. They weren't even involved in the shenanigans that were occurring, so the situation that was said to be an emergency situation wasn't something that they were involved in or contributed to at all. And yet, if we're going to cast blame against children, which I don't really think we should, but like if we're going to go there, Josiah Binsaris and Kieran Webster were involved. They had spit hoods placed on them, leg shackles, they were cuffed behind rather than in front. That seems extreme and inhumane. They were the fellows who were actually involved in the unrest, but these poor kids, Kieran Webster and Leroy O'Shea, had exactly the same treatment, and all they were doing was playing cards in their cell. And can I say that all of these kids were completely vulnerable? They were at the mercy of adults in this detention center. Whether you think that they were behaving badly or not doesn't justify what happened to them, because we need to remember these are children. If we think about it analogous to how we might deal with our own families or behavior that we might see out and about, if we saw a child behaving in a dangerous manner, we probably would feel worried. We would probably feel compassion. We might be thinking that maybe some restraint could be used to keep them safe and to maybe stop them from hurting other people if that was going to occur. But I think we would all be horrified if we saw that situation escalate, and let's say a parent decided, you know what, I'm going to have to tear gas my kid, and after I do that, I'll pop him in a spit hood, and I might shackle his legs, and you know what, I might cuff his hands behind his back. Oh, and these other kids who are nearby, my other kids, well, shit, I accidentally got them with the tear gas. They're probably not super happy about that, so you know what, I'll also pop them in spit hoods. I'll shackle their legs. I'll cuff them behind their back. I'm going to hose them down in the yard just for good measure. If we saw that out of the context of a detention centre, if we just think about these people as children, and we saw anyone behaving like that, I think we'd probably be horrified. And I'd probably be having to run off to throw up. I would be so sickened. I think it's really important that we reflect on how the different context potentially numbs us to what we're seeing and what we think is acceptable treatment of people. It's like this happening in a detention center for some of us makes it justifiable and normal. And I would like you to question your thinking around that. Just because we have become desensitized to seeing violence occurring within prison type settings, either amongst detainees or against them, that doesn't mean that it's right. It doesn't mean that it's something that we should just take for granted and not critically think about. And I want you to take a couple of minutes to just reflect on that. If we get back to the legal nuts and bolts of the matter in Justice Gordon and Justice Edelman's joint decision, they've noted that a prison officer in the detention centre is not acting as a prison officer. They might think they are, but actually their powers and the definition of what a prison officer is does not apply to a detention centre. So they found that the use of the CS Fogger was not authorised. For that reason, they also thought that the matter should be remitted to the Northern Territory Supreme Court for a judge there to make appropriate orders about damages to be awarded. So you will see that all five of the judges involved thought that the appeal should be allowed. They all thought that each of these appellants, each of these four kids, who are probably adults now, I think, who were in the Dondale Detention Centre, should be successful in their claims for battery in relation to the use of the CS Fogger. They arrived there by different routes. Four of them arrived there the same way. One arrived there in a different way. What it's really important to understand is that the High Court of Australia is only allowed to rule on what comes before it. And the way they make their decisions is by carefully reading the legislation. If the Prisons Act or the Youth Justice Act had been drafted in a different way, in a way that allowed the use of the CS Fogger, in a way that said perhaps that a prison officer was a prison officer even when they were in a youth detention centre, then the High Court would have ruled differently in this matter. They would have said that the behaviour was authorised and that these appellants weren't entitled to damages for a claim in battery. Our legal system is not particularly activist. The judges don't get to have a think about what they think is socially the right thing to do and make a decision accordingly. They're very much constrained by the letter of the law. And if you do go through and read this decision, you'll see that. My view is that by talking about other aspects of the youth justice law that set out that violence isn't to be used and things like that, they are showing us in their judgment by addressing things that they don't strictly need to address, but they're making a note of it, that they do think that it is bad that violence was used in these circumstances. And I think that because, yeah, as I said, they've gone beyond simply talking about the very bone dry letter of the law and simply ruling on that. I think we have a clue in this about what the High Court actually thinks about this kind of behaviour and the ways that, let's say, discipline and good order is said to be attempted to be maintained in this detention centre at the time of this incident. For people like you and me, the takeaway from this is not that the High Court thinks that the behaviour is morally wrong. We can't go that far. All we can say is that the High Court isn't there to make moral decisions. They've perhaps given us some clues about what they really think about it, but they've stuck to the absolute letter of the law. Now, what that means is that you and I, as people in this country who are able to vote, need to make sure that our elected representatives, who make our laws, understand what our views are about what people should be allowed to do and not allowed to do in places like youth detention centres. Every state and territory in Australia has incarcerated adults and incarcerated kids. We need to be very vocal, in my humble opinion, about what we demand in terms of the treatment of these people. You might think that people who are in jail all deserve to be there because they've done something wrong. You might be more like me, where you're very skeptical of whether many people in jail should be there. I'm not someone who would go so far personally as to call for the abolition of all forms of imprisonment. Just with my personal experiences in the law, it does seem that there are some people from whom we need protection. But my very strong view is that just because someone is in custody does not take away their dignity. It doesn't change the way that they should be treated. It doesn't mean that they should be subjected to violence, degrading treatment, inhumane treatment, ridicule, any kind of emotional torture, any kind of bad treatment simply by virtue of the fact that they're in jail. We need to think about people who are in jail as being the same as us. We need to think about how we would like to be treated, how we would like our children or our family members to be treated if they were in similar situations, because my strong suspicion is that knowing what you know about how these kids were treated in Don Dale, you probably don't think that's okay. You might not have full sympathy for them because you might think, well, look, they partly brought it on themselves, but my view is that it's pretty common for people who are locked up to be bored. It's pretty common for them to be rebelling, and I need you to have a serious think about whether it's reasonable and okay for people who are incarcerated, vulnerable, at the mercy of other people, to be dosed with CS gas, then put in spit hoods, having their legs shackled, being handcuffed behind their backs and hosed down in the yard. It doesn't sound great, and to me it sounds like it's far beyond whatever punishment we as a society would have expected these people to have. And let's not forget, in this case, we're talking about children. So, thank you so much for listening to this really long episode about the decision in this particular matter. As I said, it's limited to its facts. It really is just talking about the use of CS gas in a juvenile detention centre. If you want to read it for yourself or try and find more information, the matter is known as Binsaris against the Northern Territory. You can find it on the High Court of Australia website, and I'm sure that there is a lot more commentary that you will be able to locate to get more information about Don Dale Detention Centre in general. There are other notable incidents that have arisen in there that you will probably find information about. And you may also wish to do some further research in general about the High Court, who's on the court at the moment, how they make their decisions, and how they are constrained to only rule on the case that's in front of them and not to go broader. There is a movement at the moment looking to raise the age of criminal responsibility. The High Court noted in its judgment in this matter that some of the people in the detention centre were as young as 10 years old. That seems pretty young to me. There has always been a question at criminal law about whether a child has the capacity to know that what they are doing is wrong, and that is assessed at the moment on a case-by-case basis. Some people are urging the governments to change their age of criminal responsibility to make it at minimum 14 years. They say that people under that age probably don't understand what they're doing, whether that's right or wrong. Now, I don't have a firm view on that. My view is that probably it needs to be assessed on a case-by-case basis, but that there are some circumstances where there probably should be a presumption against someone having the capacity to know and understand their actions, and that that probably needs to be assessed depending on the person involved, and probably has to take into account the seriousness of what they're charged with as well, because it may be the case that as a society we might think, well gosh, I am actually not sure whether that 10-year-old understood what they did, but the effect of what they did was so severe that we need to look at it a bit more closely. I can see with some sympathy that position. What I would like you to do is have a think about this issue for yourself. Do you think that children should be considered capable of bearing criminal responsibility for their actions? Do you think that even if they are capable, perhaps a different path should be followed wherever possible, steering them out of the courts and into different programs perhaps? What do you think? I want you to have a think about what we might do as a society to make things better. Just because we've always done things one way doesn't mean we have to keep doing that, and it doesn't mean that it's the best way forward. It might just mean that we haven't thought about it carefully enough in light of different information and things that we now know. I want to thank you for listening to this long and pretty heavy episode of the Not Just a Lawyer podcast. I want to thank you for having a think about things that have been raised in this episode. There is a lot to consider. I also want to give a big shout out to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander legal services around Australia. They do a fantastic job. They deal not only with criminal law, but also with family law and domestic violence matters. And I understand that some may also deal with civil matters. I have some cats running around like wild beasts in the background, so please excuse their crazy noises. I also want to give a strong shout out to the various state and territory legal aid commissions around Australia. They also represent a large number of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander clients, and they also do their share of the heavy lifting in this area. And finally, I couldn't go without acknowledging the wonderful work of various community legal centres around Australia. Community legal centres help a wide variety of Australians. Sometimes they specialise in terms of helping people with low economic capacity. Sometimes they specialise in helping women, migrants, people from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds. If you have a legal issue and you can't afford a lawyer, there is likely to be a community legal centre near you who will help you with open arms. So I want to give a shout out to those community legal centres, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander legal services, and the legal aid services around Australia. The work that they do is invaluable, and you will see if you have a look at this judgment that these four boys were represented by an Aboriginal legal service. So thank you so much for listening, and thank you to our wonderful lawyers who take on these matters at a low cost or at no cost, because it's necessary for justice in Australia. Thank you.